From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast of the best of weekends and all things considered, the highlights from our shows this weekend. I'm Guy Raz, the host of the program on Saturday and Sunday. This episode, in 1937, President Roosevelt thought he licked the Depression, so he adopted austerity. And then
unemployment shot up. The economy stagnated. The stock market crashed again.
And some modern economists are warning we're headed down the same exact path today. Also, James Fallows and the Eddie Haskell of Congress. Plus,
clear eyes, full hearts, you can't lose. We believe that.
Peter Berg, the creator of the TV series, gets emotional as he turns out the lights on Friday nights. And why does fantasy writer George R.R. Martin tend to kill off his best characters?
No one is safe in these books. The cavalry isn't necessarily going to come riding to the rescue. Mm.
And later, the son of legendary African musician Fela Kuti carries the torch for Afrobeat. Sheyun Kuti's our musical guest. That's all on this episode of the Best of Weekends and All Things Considered. Here's a story some economists call a cautionary tale. In 1936, President Franklin Roosevelt was running for a second term. Now, when he came into office in 1933, more than one out of every five working-age Americans were unemployed. But by 1936, he more than halved the unemployment rate, and he did it through the massive government spending plan known as the New Deal. Now, at the same time, he introduced new banking and corporate regulations that angered big business, which in turn accused Roosevelt of trampling on free enterprise. And in that year, 1936, Roosevelt decided to embrace that opposition, even wear it as a badge of honor, during his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention at Madison Square Garden in New York.
We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism.
He read the temper of the times correctly.
That's Donald Ritchie, the official historian for the U.S. Senate, who's written about FDR.
People didn't think very much of the bankers and the businessmen because they felt they had gotten them into the Depression in the first place. So his speeches in 1936, they take a very strong anti-business tone.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
Now, this tone worked for Roosevelt. He was reelected in a landslide. And by the time he was inaugurated in January 1937, the unemployment rate was down to around 9%, a dramatic drop. And it looked like the Depression was finally winding down.
People felt that there was momentum and that finally there was the light at the end of the tunnel. And so Roosevelt and a lot of his advisors felt this was the time now to move away from deficit spending, which they'd done for 4 years, to try to balance the budget and to try to let the economy stand on its own 2 feet.
And no one pushed harder for this than Henry Morgenthau. He was Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, and he also had close ties to Wall Street. And Morgenthau was worried about growing debt and deficits. And since the economy was turning a corner anyway, he pushed Roosevelt to take austerity measures, to cut back.
And there was a lot of support in Congress from that. You know, the congressional committee chairmen were mostly Southern Democrats who were more conservative than Roosevelt was, and they were encouraging Roosevelt to cut back on spending and to balance the budget. There were people in Roosevelt's administration who were arguing just the opposite, of course. There were ones saying, no, wait, you can't take away the props from the economy yet. We need more government spending. But Roosevelt listened to the budget balancer.
So for the next 2 years, Roosevelt introduced new taxes and slashed government spending by 17%. And then,
all of a sudden, after unemployment had been going steadily down, unemployment shot up. The economy stagnated. The stock market crashed again. Now it seemed that we'd come out of the Hoover Depression to go into the Roosevelt Recession.
Our cover story today, lessons from 1937. As the debt ceiling talks between the White House and congressional Republicans drag on and on, both Democrats and Republicans seem to agree that economic austerity in some form is going to have to happen. President Obama wants to cut spending by $4 trillion over the next decade. Republicans say they want to see dramatic cuts happen over the next year. But could either of those proposals take us right back into recession? Here's Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, who was the top economic advisor to President Obama.
I just wrote an op-ed in which I urged the importance of continuing unemployment insurance, more infrastructure investment. I do think that it's important to recognize that most of what's under discussion in the budget talks is commitments today with respect to budget deficit reduction 3 and 5 and 10 years from now. Committing now to future deficit reduction is a sound thing to do. Rushing to deficit reduction was Roosevelt's mistake in 1937, and that would be a serious mistake today.
What you're saying, and I'm just using simple language here, is that there ought to be more stimulus right now.
The right strategy is more stimulus now and more deficit reduction programmed for after the economy has recovered.
But many of the things that you're talking about are being done as we speak. The payroll tax, the extension of unemployment benefits, aid to states. And yet the unemployment rate, as you know, just hit 9.2%. So what's the problem? Why isn't it working?
Well, aid to state and local governments is phasing out. The unemployment insurance is phasing out. And it is working in the sense, and this doesn't give people as much satisfaction as they want to have, quite rightly, it is working in the sense that without that support for the economy, things would have been much worse.
You were, of course, had a seat at the table under two presidents, including this president, Obama. But essentially what I'm hearing is that you believe there needs to be an additional injection of cash into the economy. You know the politics. You know how complicated that is. What is feasible, in your view, given the current political atmosphere?
What's possible? We saw a positive example at the end of last year when the president and the Congress came together to extend tax cuts another 2 years, which put more money into consumers' pockets. I'd like to see that payroll tax cut extended for another year. Unemployment insurance is expected to expire at the end of this year. That's a serious mistake while we have 9% unemployment. I think that's an important idea that should be recognized right now as well.
Do you think the administration did enough? In other words, why does it seem as if this recovery really isn't much of a recovery at all?
The recovery has been slow. If the politics had permitted a larger approach, if the proposals that the president put forward in the fall of 2009 and that the House of Representatives acted on to support infrastructure investment, to incentivize hiring, if those measures had passed, then we clearly would be in a better position today, but those were blocked in the Senate. But there's no question that it's going to be important for the president to put the jobs deficit as our top economic issue until we've return to normal levels of employment.
Larry Summers, we talked to a lot of economists on this program, Nobel Prize winners and others. I often ask them this question, and I want to put it to you. How long is this crisis going to last? When do you believe the U.S. economy will be back to where it should be?
Oh, I think we're still several years away. We say that in a technical sense, the recession is over. That means that the economy is growing. But when you walk through the Grand Canyon, you're going uphill long before you get back to sea level. And I think we've got several years before this economy's back to normal levels of employment.
That's former Treasury Secretary and White House Economic Advisor Larry Summers. He spoke to me from Massachusetts. Larry Summers, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In the years leading up to the recession, journalist Gillian Tett was one of the first people to warn that something new and dangerous was happening in the global credit market, and she predicted the collapse. Many in the financial industry had dismissed her warnings. Today, she's the U.S. managing editor for the Financial Times, and her background? It's not in finance, but in anthropology, which is one reason, she says, economists like Larry Summers aren't the only people with the answers.
Because right now, issues like, say, social cohesion are crucial for understanding what's going on. Something has always struck me about America by comparison with a country like Japan, where I used to live, is that America is not a country which has a very strong sense of resource constraint. It was created by pioneers who came here believing that there would always be more resources, precisely because they were pioneers. And there's been such a focus on growing the economic pie that people haven't really stopped to ask, how do you divide up that economic pie? And now, for perhaps the first time in American history, maybe that pie is not going to always keep growing. And yet politicians are avoiding talking about that fundamental issue, partly because there simply isn't the cultural mechanism in place to talk about it.
Gillian, from a European perspective, and we'll just for a moment forget that there are also major problems in Europe, but how is this debt ceiling issue being viewed overseas? I mean, do people look at the debate happening in Washington and think, what's going on there?
Well, the grim reality is that the situation in the Eurozone right now is so bad that most people can barely see beyond their own crisis.
Yeah.
But if they are looking to the US, what I hear European policymakers and investors saying is they find it quite unbelievable that a country would, in a sense, choose to walk into a debt crisis, particularly given that people in Europe are having a debt crisis imposed on them without choice, and they know how bad it is. There is a sense of incomprehension that the politicians can't sit around the table and come up with some kind of proactive plan. There's a fascinating contrast between the fact you have many fantastic American companies today, which are frankly awesome in terms of how they're run, how they execute plans, their vision. And there are parts of the American government today which are like that, but the political system is extraordinarily inept. And frankly, a lot of time and a lot of resources is being wasted today. And more importantly, America, sadly, is failing to get to grips with some of its really crucial issues going forward.
Larry Summers told us just a few moments ago that this crisis is going to last at least a few more years. A pretty sobering prediction from him.
It's a very sobering prediction, and it makes the question of social cohesion and the question of whether America has a way of allocating pain while also ensuring that people pull together even more pertinent. Because the fact is that social divisions have been widening, tribalism has been growing here in America, and income inequality has also been increasing. And that is going to create more and more tensions going forward. And, you know, I love America. I think it's got so much to be proud of. I just really hope that it finds a way to tackle these problems, but also, above all else, do so in a way that ensures that everyone continues to buy into the system.
That's Gillian Tett. She's the U.S. Managing Editor of the Financial Times. Gillian Tett, thank you.
Thank you.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
We are going to abide by our principles, and that's how it is, and I'm sure the Speaker joins me in that.
Any suggestion that the role that Eric has played in this meeting has been anything less than helpful is just wrong.
Republican House leaders Eric Cantor and John Boehner speaking to reporters yesterday about the ongoing stalemate over raising the nation's debt ceiling. Many in Washington are wondering whether there's a growing split between the two men. James Fallows of The Atlantic might have that answer. He's with me now, as he is most Saturdays. Jim, let's start with that stalemate. Unless congressional Republicans agree to raise the maximum amount of money the federal government can borrow, the Obama administration says the U.S. goes into default August 2nd. That is looking increasingly likely.
Yes, and just to be clear for anybody who's still in doubt about this is both a very strange part of our governing system and a potentially very big problem. This is money past Congresses and this Congress, too, have already voted to spend. So in a way, it's as if you put charges on your credit card and then decide later whether you're going to pay for them. The other factor about why it matters is that ratings agencies have already said that even though, of course, people know that the U.S. government is not going to finally renege on its obligations, the interest rate that the U.S. has to pay for its Treasury notes and other debt will probably go up if there is this default, because it's always been defined as the most riskless investment in the world. And if and when that happens, essentially interest rates for everything else, for mortgages, for city governments, for state governments, they will all go up too, because almost all of them are benchmarked to the supposedly riskless Treasury rate.
And presumably those rising interest rates are going to have to be passed down to taxpayers, right, to pay for it.
Oh, exactly. And I think even worse than that is at a time when the economy's recovery is very much in question, there's nothing like an interest rate shock to send things back in the wrong direction.
Jim, it seemed as if the Speaker, John Boehner, and President Obama were close to coming to a deal. You have written that you think the primary reason the White House and congressional Republicans have not made a deal is because of one man, Eric Cantor, the Republican House Majority Leader. In your blog this week, Jim, you compared him to Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver. You called him a weasel.
I said he was acting like a weasel, and I will try to explain respectfully what I was saying, that the parties to this dispute are not the Republicans and the Democrats or the president and the Congress, but I think it really is, on the one side, the president plus the mainstream of the Republican Party, if you will, who are united in thinking that a default can't be allowed to occur. And on the other hand, you have the Tea Party faction of the Republican majority in the House, which is a sizable amount, led by Representative Cantor, who are acting as if it doesn't really matter if this default occurs. They'd rather bring on the default than compromise on the thing that matters most to them, which is raising taxes. The part of Representative Cantor's comportment, which is I think has not been great, is his going right out of these negotiating sessions in the White House and saying all the offers that the administration has made and essentially assuming them on the table, then saying we want even more. And that has not helped the negotiations.
Let me turn to another big story, Jim. Two top-level resignations from Rupert Murdoch's media empire this week, of course, in the wake of that phone hacking scandal. I was reading The Economist last night. They are comparing Murdoch's rapid reversal of fortune to Hosni Mubarak in Egypt.
Think of what's happened just in the past 10 days now. A major newspaper in England has been closed, the News of the World. The Murdoch interests have abandoned the biggest deal of Murdoch's career, the attempt to purchase all the B-Sky B network. His closest lieutenant in England, Rebecca Brooks, has resigned. His closest lieutenant in the U.S., Les Hinton, has resigned. And there's no sign that this is over.
You noted that there was largely an absence of a lot of coverage of the story in two Murdoch-owned U.S. enterprises, the Wall Street Journal and Fox News.
The more surprising of the omissions was from the Wall Street Journal as opposed to Fox News. Fox News has its supporters and its detractors, but its political identity is known. What was startling to me was that in yesterday's front section of the Wall Street Journal, there was no story about this huge controversy that was front page news every place else. There was a little tiny box in the front page saying, see the B section for more about the Murdoch story. But there, in the entire front section of the newspaper, there was nothing.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
It's Monday morning, and we all know what that means. Only 4 days till Friday night.
5 years ago, the TV series Friday Night Lights debuted on NBC. The show is set in Dillon, Texas, a fictional town where life revolves around high school football.
Who wants to talk Panther football? I'm all ears.
The show's final episode aired last night, and although Friday Night Lights was never a ratings hit, it did earn a hardcore and devoted following. And this week, the series earned its first Emmy nomination for Best Drama. Friday Night Lights began as a book by journalist Buzz Bissinger about a real West Texas town and its football team. And 15 years later, director Peter Berg made it into a film. And while he was collecting footage of real high school football for that movie, he saw something that changed his life.
We were filming a playoff game in Austin, Texas. It was a school from Austin called Austin Westlake, which is a very good football school. And they were playing a school from San Antonio Madison High School. And early in the fourth quarter, kind of right in front of me, there was a collision. And a young man, a 15-year-old boy named David Edwards, left his feet and lowered his head and speared an Austin Westlake receiver. And in that collision, David Edwards became an instant quadriplegic. He suffered an explosion fracture of one of his upper vertebrates. And that kind of put me in a pretty serious mode to go ahead and tackle the series. And it became, you know, more than just a piece of entertainment for me at that point.
Peter Berg turned that experience into the defining moment of the TV series' first episode, when the star quarterback of the Dillon Panthers makes a tackle and ends up paralyzed.
Why isn't he getting up?
That first episode set the storyline for the next five seasons, as the characters encounter failure, success, and challenges as true to life as anything on television. And at its center is the Panthers' head coach, Eric Taylor. Peter Berg says he originally wanted country star Dwight Yoakam for that role, but instead settled for Kyle Chandler.
I think he was kind of hung over the day I met with him. He didn't look so good, and he had bags under his eyes, and he was kind of just breathing heavy and hadn't shaved. And I'm like, you look perfect for this role. And he's like, yeah. And I said, well, whatever you're doing, whatever you do, he said he got real drunk playing poker the night before. I said, well, you should play this role, but you should play poker and drink every night before you work. And it was just lucky and fortuitous that I met with Kyle and that I was encouraged to do so, because he was and is the heart of Friday Night Lights. And he's just was the right guy at the right time. So it all worked out.
I think, and as you know, a lot of critics who've seen this show have pointed to the marriage between Coach Taylor and his wife Tammy. She's played by Connie Britton. It's been described as one of the most realistic portrayals of marriage on TV. As somebody who is married, I would agree with that. How much of that was the chemistry between the two actors?
These two, for whatever reason, were able to do what very few actors can do. They were able to work together for a very long time without ever sleeping with each other, which is critical. That never ends well. But without ever really getting into any catastrophic fights or arguments or personality issues, they became great friends, and they just had this chemistry, and they had it from the very first day they met. And that marriage became, I think, one of the dominant experiences of Friday Night Lights. And we never saw that coming. You know, they just developed this way of reacting with each other, oftentimes kind of non-verbally, that made it unique.
Hi.
For me, their greatest moment was when they were out on the balcony of a hotel room, and she told him that she was pregnant again.
I'm pregnant.
What did she say?
We had written a bunch of stuff, and they just decided they were going to just start laughing, right, and then crying. They just, you know, took what could have been a familiar scene, a woman announcing in it that they were unexpectedly pregnant, and turning it into something very unique.
I love you.
I love you.
They had a knack for finding these little moments like that, and you know, that I credit them almost entirely with that ability.
I'm speaking with Peter Berg. He's a creator of the TV show Friday Night Lights, which ended last night. The kids, these high school kids in the show, they also felt so real, so three-dimensional. How did you make them that way?
80% of getting the right actor is, you know, you just got to cast well. Because once you make the choice, that is pretty much who you're going to get. And so we were really pretty intense in our audition process, and would make actors audition by improvising a lot. You know, we'd have them play a character like they were gay, or they were on drugs, or they were the president of the United States, or they didn't speak English. We would throw like any curveball we could at them and see who could kind of handle it and who would get excited about that and play with it. And those would be the actors that we would be drawn to. And that's why, you know, guys like Taylor Kitsch and Minka Kelly.
Taylor Kitsch, who plays Tim Riggins, and Minka Kelly, who plays Lila.
Yes. And Jesse Plemons, who plays Landry Clark. They all really were into the idea of playing. And I think that was true of all the young actors in Friday Night Lights.
In the locker room at Dillon High, emblazoned towards the ceiling, and a slogan that you would hear Coach Taylor say often, clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. It's a great slogan. Where does it come from?
Well, I'm proud to say I wrote that slogan. and, you know, I'd been in locker rooms in Texas, and I've seen coaches ask for the players to look at each other in the eyes. And that was always a very emotional moment for me, to see these young boys holding hands, looking at each other in the eyes, kind of making this agreement that they were going to go out there and they were going to look after each other and they were going to fight for each other and protect each other.
They're going to come at you with everything they've got. I expect you boys to execute.
Yes, sir.
Expect you boys to play football.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose.
You know, I think it's true that if your eyes are clear and your heart's in the right place, it's pretty hard to lose in life. So I believe in that, and I think it's a good mantra for our show.
This has been 5 years of your life, and it's over. And presumably the cast and the crew of this TV series have become like a family. Are you ready for this all to end?
No. How about that? You know, it's funny, you know, right now I'm making a documentary about spinal cord injuries in football and concussions, brain injuries in football. And that has all been inspired by the show. And so that the show continues to live on now through that form. And there's even talk about other ways of keeping the show alive and that we're discussing now, which I don't want to tip any hands, but I will say that it might not be the end of Friday Night Lights as people know it right now.
Well, I hope not. That's director Peter Berg. He's the executive producer and creator of the TV show Friday Night Lights. It aired its final episode this week on NBC. Peter, thank you so much.
Well, hey, thank you for your support. And any fans of Friday Night Lights out there listening, thank you. We all appreciate it. And clear eyes, full hearts, you can't lose. We believe that. Didn't know it was a devil town. Oh, Lord, it really brings me down about the devil town. All my friends were vampires. Didn't know they were vampires. Turns out I was a vampire myself in the devil town.
Time now for music. Today, the legendary Fela Kuti's youngest son, Sheyun, carries the torch for Afrobeat. Now, you simply cannot overstate the importance of Fela Kuti. This is his music we're hearing. He pioneered the brassy and political sound known as Afrobeat. In the 70s and 80s, he was to Nigeria what Bob Marley was to Jamaica, informed, outspoken, a champion of the underclass, and a target of successive military rulers. Fela Kuti died in 1997, leaving his band Egypt 80 in the hands of his then 14-year-old son, Sheyun. The ruler set for Africa, the black race must be free. Yes, yes, forget. Sheyun is now 28. This is a track off of his new record. He still tours and records with his father's old bandmates. And together they put this new record out. It's called From Africa with Fury Rise. And Sheyun Kuti joins me from our studios in Southern California. Sheyun Kuti, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
What a track. And while there is certainly a different vibe, it's impossible not to hear your father's sound and spirit. Your father passed away when you were just 14 years old. You were entrusted with leading his band, Egypt 80. That must have been an amazing amount of pressure on you. I mean, this is you're taking over a band of the most legendary Nigerian musician ever.
Well, Fela was first and foremost, you know, a friend and a father to me than before he was a legendary musician, you know. And I'd already started playing with the band since I was 8. You know, I used to open the shows for him. Being a part of the band, I always saw how he treated everybody in the band and how important it was to him, you know. So when he died, I only felt it natural that if the family wasn't going to do anything and they just want the band to go, I was not going to allow that. So I just said, you know what, we're going to keep playing, you know, and here we are today.
Did you have to sort of face, you know, fans who were saying, oh, he's trying to capture his dad's legacy?
And I still face that till today. Mm. It's not going to change. You know, that's, you know, you have to accept that as being part of who you are, you know. Even if I was a scientist, people would still say, well, his science is not as revolutionary as his father's. He's not coming up with any new science.
Imagine being Einstein's kid.
You see what I'm saying? I say African soldiers, them not the handover. I fight them this step to drop the
uniform. Go for Agada, so take cover them boots. I mentioned Bob Marley earlier in my introduction about the importance of Fela Kuti to Nigeria. Bob Marley, of course, is sort of canonized now, not just in Jamaica, but around the world. What do you think it will take for people to recognize Fela Kuti's importance on that level?
Well, you know, at the same time, you know, I think comparing my Fela and Bob, you know, it's not really fair because, you know, my dad was this uncompromising, staunch, you know, socialist with absolutely no interest in commercial success whatsoever. Mm. he didn't believe in, like Bob, that love could heal the world. You know, my dad believed that love was a Western concept brought to Africa to deceive us. My dad believed in the struggle and the revolution. I think Bob wanted change from a different place. You know, it was like a Malcolm X and a Martin Luther King comparison. I declare for my country when I see I'm in the hands of these people. Yeah, yeah. I declare for Africa when I see I'm in the hands of these people.
My guest is Sheyun Kuti. He's the youngest son of legendary Afrobeat bandleader Fela Kuti. Sheyun's new album is called From Africa with Fury, Rise. This is a political record, much like your father's work. In the track Rise, you sing, "And I cry for my country when I see him in the hands of these people, and I cry for Africa when I see him in the hands of these people." Are the kinds of issues your father sang about, are they similar to today's problems in Nigeria, or are they completely different?
I don't think they're completely different. I think it's similar, you know. It's still the same nepotism we go through where people use the power that they have to enrich themselves, you know, forgetting that power is supposed to be used to empower your people and, you know, secure their future. The only thing different is that my father fought a military dispensation and now we have to contend with a so-called democracy, you know, a civilian dispensation. I think that's the only thing different.
The current president of Nigeria, Goodluck Jonathan, is not a military man. Nigeria was traditionally ruled by military men, certainly over the course of your father's life. And you say things are not different.
No, I don't think things are different. Everybody that is powerful in Nigeria is still a military man. Jonathan does not have, he doesn't even have security of the country at the moment. You know, and Jonathan has to play and sing and dance with them. You know, there's no escaping it. For the stones, we must rise against all African rulers.
Your father was harassed by the government his whole life, imprisoned. Relatives and bandmates were killed. Obviously, you don't face the same kind of harassment, but do you face any kind of backlash from official Nigeria because of what you do and what you say?
Fela himself in Nigeria is played on the radio probably 5-6 times in a month. Mm. You know, put together on all radio stations.
Wow,
you know,
that's it.
Yeah, so imagine me. You know, being anti-establishment in Africa is being anti-everything because everything is owned by the establishment. You know, so it's kind of hard. You know, you go through some kind of, you know, drawbacks. But, you know, Afrobeat music is not local anymore. It's global, you know.
My understanding now is that most young people in Nigeria listen to hip-hop. That's the most popular sort of style of music in Nigeria. What do young people think about Afrobeat? I mean, are they receptive to this sound that was so popular in the 70s and in the 80s?
Well, you have to understand that in the 70s and the 80s, we did not have MTV culture dominating everywhere in Africa, and the TV just constantly filling everybody's eyes with bling-bling and big cars and big houses and beautiful women. You know, everybody wants this life, and, you know, that's what they give them on TV. So Afrobeat is not as popular as it should be back home.
Do you sort of feel like you have this responsibility to carry your father's legacy on?
No, I don't feel it's my responsibility. I feel it's the responsibility of every African artist, you know, because right now African art has a big role to play in inspiring the people of Africa. You know, if we think that Africa is going to be saved by the West, then we have a big problem still in Africa. You know, trying to create our own identity should be our supreme goal, and our art should be at the forefront of that.
Your father believed that music could change his country, maybe the world. Do you believe that?
Yeah, definitely.
Sheyun Kuti, he leads his father Fela's old band called Egypt 80. Their new album is called From Africa with Fury, Rise. If you'd like to hear a few tracks, they're at our website, nprmusic.org. Sheyun Kuti, thank you so very much.
Yeah, man. My pleasure to be here.
Our book today is best described as a phenomenon. In the 1980s, George R.R. Martin was a Hollywood writer churning out episodes for TV shows like Beauty and the Beast. And then he got bored.
Whenever I would turn in the script, the producers would always say to me, George, this is wonderful, but it would cost five times our budget to produce it.
So Martin turned to the one medium that could support his oversized imagination, fiction. And the result was A Game of Thrones, the first volume in an epic fantasy series based loosely on the English dynastic struggle known as the Wars of the Roses, with a few dragons and demons thrown in. 15 years later, George R.R. Martin's series, known as A Song of Ice and Fire, has sold more than 15 million copies, and he's inspired the kind of cult loyalty known only to a handful of living writers. The latest installment in the series has just been released. It's called A Dance with Dragons. And a few weeks ago, HBO wrapped up the first season of a show based on Game of Thrones. Critics are calling it the finest HBO series in years, and it's just earned an Emmy nomination for Best Drama.
And winter is coming.
Martin says that he knew his fantasy epic was going to be big, but it's actually grounded in real-life history.
Many years ago, when I'm visiting England, I visited Hadrian's Wall.
Oh, yes.
In the north of England. And I climbed up on top of Hadrian's Wall, and I stared off north towards Scotland, and it was autumn, and a cold wind was blowing, and I just tried to imagine what it was like to be a Roman legionary from southern Italy, standing on this wall, not knowing what was going to emerge from those hills or those trees. And it was sort of a profound feeling, and I said, I've got to capture this in a fantasy book. But of course, fantasy being bigger and more colorful, I couldn't have a wall that was 10 feet tall like Hadrian's Wall. So I had a 700-foot tall wall, and I made it out of ice, and I gave it this storied history. And then, of course, I wanted something to emerge from those hills and trees to the north. That was a good bit scarier than Scott.
Yes.
So I came up with that, too. So you start with the kernel of reality, and then you extrapolate and you build from there.
George, for people who are not familiar with your work, and there are very few of them left these days, you create these characters that we root for, that we really become attached to very quickly. We want to see them win. And then you kill them.
Well, not all of them. I have a lot of characters, so there are always more who hopefully you are also attached to.
Why do you do that?
I think there's a certain moral obligation almost to give one reason. If you're going to write about war, which my books are about, wars are nasty things. People die in wars. People get maimed in wars. And many of them are good, likable people who you would like to not see die. I think it's sort of a cheap, easy way out to write a war story in which all the heroes, you know, happily go killing the enemy, and maybe they have a few close calls, but no one ultimately dies. So that's one reason. But the other reason besides that is also my goal as a writer is to really make my readers experience the book. Not just read the words, but to feel afterwards almost as if they've lived it. I want the reader to be afraid. I want the reader not to know, my God, is this character that I'm identifying with and reading going to survive this thing? He's really in trouble here. He's really in a scary situation. To almost be afraid to turn the next page.
Yeah.
And the way you do that, of course, is by establishing very early on, as I do in Game of Thrones, that I'm playing for keeps here and that no one is safe in these books. The cavalry isn't necessarily going to come riding to the rescue. Mm.
I'm speaking with author George R.R. Martin. His new book is called A Dance with Dragons. It's the latest in a series that began with Game of Thrones, the TV series based on that book, just finished its first season on HBO. George, you've been called the American Tolkien. You are a huge fan of his work.
I am indeed.
What do you make of that? Does it, I don't know, does it make you feel uncomfortable?
No, it's immensely flattering. It's one of the greatest compliments that could be made to my work, and so I'm glad to accept it. I do caution people though that you know, fans of Tolkien who hear that and then pick up my books thinking that they're going to get the same thing. Well, they're not. I mean, I am a significantly different person from Tolkien, although we're both writing in a genre that's come to be called epic fantasy or high fantasy. Of course, one of the big differences is that my work has sex. One of the other things I tried to do is create characters who are fully fleshed and hopefully three-dimensional with realistic motivations on all sides of the struggle. I mean, there are no orcs in A Game of Thrones and its sequels. There are no equivalent. There are no, like, demonic creatures who just exist to be evil. Most of the violence is done by human beings against other human beings, and for the same old reasons that people have been doing violence against each other through all of human history. You know, a lust for power, revenge, love, all of the things that have motivated some of these wars through the real Middle Ages.
George Martin, it's hard to talk about your new book, A Dance with Dragons, because, of course, many folks listening are your fans, and they will not have read it yet. So we really can't give anything
That's right.
away.
No spoilers. No spoilers.
But let me talk about the drama surrounding the book, because the last book in the series came out in 2005, and some of your readers were just downright vicious in their impatience waiting for this one.
Yes, there were a few of those. You know, I struggled with that for a while, and I finally came to terms with it, and there's an old Rick Nelson song that I put a excerpt from on my blog about the garden party.
Oh, yes.
You can't please everyone, so you right. learn to please yourself.
Right.
I'm going to take as long as it takes to write these books to make them good.
Let me ask you about the cult around your series. A lot of these fans sometimes know more about the details in your books than you might even remember, right?
Yes. Well, particularly Elio Garcia and Linda Antonsen, who run the Westeros website. They're two fans who live in Sweden, and they really do have an encyclopedic knowledge of my books, more so than I do, actually. I call up Elio sometimes when I want to check a detail and say, this character, have I ever mentioned what color his eyes is? Elio will write me back right away, yes, his eyes are blue-gray. You said that in the second book on page 314. Okay, good, thanks.
Just in case, George R. R. Martin, we have to wait another 6 years. And fine, by all means, take your time.
I hope not.
If you have to take your time, take your time. But if we have to wait 6 years for the next book, can you give us a glimpse, a tiny glimpse, so a tiny clue about what we can expect?
Well, the next book is called Winds of Winter, and it will pick up directly from the end of both Dance with Dragons and Feast for Crows, the previous book, which are two books that ran in parallel. But now I have all the characters together again, so I'm going to follow all of them. And you'll see lots of trouble at the Wall, where the White Walkers and the others are finally stirring and about to move in a major way, and continued civil war in the South, so I'll be juggling a lot of balls.
It's a brutal world, and all I can say is thank God I don't live in the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, that's probably true.
That's author George R.R. Martin. His new book is called A Dance with Dragons. The HBO series based on his book Game of Thrones returns next spring. George R.R. Martin, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends and All Things Considered. The program this week was directed by Petra Mayer and Brent Bachman and produced by Kenya Young, Phil Harrell, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Kevin Lasky, and Megan Kane. Melissa Marquis is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor, and our senior producer is Matt Martinez. I'm Guy Raz, and remember, you can always catch the entire program on your local public radio station, in most places at 5 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. We're back with a brand new podcast next weekend. Thanks for listening.